How do you inspire the fine folk of your city to dive into the printed page? A healthily stuffed newsstand is always welcome, but a scrappy selection can leave readers feeling like yesterday's news. From Hamburg to Brooklyn, we're trekking the globe in search of standout local legends of print today on The Stack. Coming up today, water and paper don't often blend, but in the case of one new Hamburg magazine, we're willing to make an exception.
We try to search for topics that are relevant, not only for people who are here, but also for people who are maybe living in London or maybe living in some other city.
Also ahead, book lovers of Brooklyn prepare to assemble. One of America's largest literary events gets underway this weekend.
There is not an overarching theme. But in the 300 authors we're featuring, there's also dozens of authors who have never appeared on our stages before.
All that coming up on The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. I'm joined today by one of our good friends, Jeremy Leslie from Mag Culture. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Always good to be here.
Well, no, it's great to have you with us. Let's kick things off by talking about, I don't know if it's your highlight of the year, but it'll certainly be one of the highlights, the Modern Magazine Conference. Can I say the legendary Modern Magazine Conference?
You can certainly say that.
Next month in October, here in London town. Yeah. Now, The Stack's been there, I think, in one shape or form, certainly the last 3 years, maybe each of the years.
I think so.
How's things going?
Going really well.
The clock is ticking.
On October the 28th, the day after, we'll look back at it as a highlight. Right now, it's a little bit of a kind of throbbing pain in the back of my head.
But it's that good, exciting mayhem.
No, absolutely.
What kinds of things have we got in store? Maybe just refresh, because perhaps some of our listeners aren't familiar. Yeah. Refresh them.
The Modern Magazine is a day of talks from magazine makers from around the world and from big magazines and small magazines and print magazines and digital publications. It's a celebration of magazine making, but it also gives some hints and ideas about how we can face up to the challenges we're facing. Mm. It's meant to be really an alternative to so many of the kind of industry conferences, which are always obsessed by business models and an ongoing insistence that we all need to focus on mobile.
Which is good. And this is the
alternative. This is the reminder that there's still a lot of really great stuff being made in print and digital, but you know, there are great magazines
out there. Well, tell us about some of the is there a sort of an overarching narrative then? How does it sort of tend to come together? Is this a thing where it comes together inside Jeremy Leslie's head?
It tends to come, that's the point we're reaching just now. Right. On the website, we've got a list of all the speakers, and I'll mention some of them in a minute, but we're at briefing stage now, so I'm liaising with all the speakers to develop those themes and to make sure that, you know, one of the things I'm really keen on, and we've always managed to do, is get people to come along and speak specifically for our audience rather than turn up and do their portfolio piece.
Yeah.
People I'm particularly excited about this year are Gail Bickler from the New York Times Magazine, the creative director there, who's doing some of the best editorial work. She has a fantastic team of people working with her, but she's the leading voice for that project.
And that is an amazing, it's consistently excellent.
And it's weekly, it's consistently every week.
I guess some people, and this might be an interesting point talking about, will say, well, yes, but you know, if you're resourced like the New York Times, then it's easy to be great when you've got the resources.
Yeah.
But I guess there's a real value in hearing from people directly, from the horses, about how their minds work. And maybe it's not just a story about resources.
It's very easy to sit back and be a little bit kind of green and show your envious eyes and say, well, they've got all the money, of course they can do it. That's not a given. There's plenty of publishers with money.
We don't have to name them, but we can do.
But I just think, you know, hearing from someone like Gail, who is at the forefront of everything, both in print and their experiments with virtual reality, is fascinating. And yes, they have fantastic resources and support and great team of people, but you know, still you're hearing from the people that are at the forefront of the industry.
And I guess also you only continue to have those resources and that backing
if you're making great output and it's successful and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
And I think an important thing there is that, I mean, you know, everyone, including the New York Times, is being challenged in terms of how what their future will be and what it should be and whether they even have a future. But I think it's really impressive that they are putting those resources into the creative side of the business rather than cutting everything and you know, reducing the quality.
Well, no, this is a bit of one of our narratives as well at Monocle. It's like, newsflash, if you spend money on actual journalism and photography and doing proper work, well, extraordinary, Jeremy. Who'd have known? People will actually
people
pay
like
for
it.
And
they want it.
Whoever predicted that? Well, maybe everybody, in fact. What else? A couple of other things. I mean, we'll probably talk more in the coming weeks.
Yeah, I'm also very excited about Christoph Amend from the editor of Zeit magazine coming over. Another great weekly magazine, but talking from the editorial point of view. A bit closer to home, a smaller project, but just as exciting visually and creatively. But then also, you know, there's the smaller magazines. We've got a number of the kind of our favourite small independents. We've got Kirsten Alguer from MacGuffin, which is a great magazine, and their third issue is just landing now. Particularly excited. I've just seen the new copy of Ladybeard, the second issue, which is superb. And the team from Ladybeard will be speaking about that issue and what they've been doing. There's a couple other things I can't mention at the moment that I hope we'll be able to mention soon.
Just watch the website. Exactly.
Another thing I'm really pleased to have managed to get is the pop cultural journalist Paul Gorman, who's right just now finishing a book about the Face magazine, which for a lot of people was a kind of very important moment in publishing. It's what kind of, in a sense, one of the first indies that broke through. Everybody involved in the Face has been quite reluctant to come forward and sort of talk about it, but he's gathered them all and has talked to them all, and he's producing a definitive book which will be published next year. So I'm very much looking forward to what he has to say about Fantastic. The Face and its continued relevance.
Now, just refresh our listeners' memories about how they can find out more and chart those other announcements. They can do it on your website, I guess.
You can find out a lot more about the entire lineup, including additional names from magculture.com. There's a big panel on there which will click you through to the site where you can find out about it, you can book your tickets, and you can keep an eye on for further announcements.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3.
It is.
Jeremy, we'll have
I should mention
you.
The date.
Oh, yeah, that's always helpful.
book out the 27th of October now.
There you go. Easy as 1, 2, 3.
Absolutely, yeah.
Jeremy, we'll have more from you in a minute. You've got some magazines. I can't wait to delve into those a little bit later here on The Stack. Gentle Rain is Hamburg's first English language magazine about the city, published by local media agency Die Brüder, founder of independent magazine conference IndieCon. Its debut issue hit newsstands this summer. It's packed with tales from the German town, from the saga of Flotsam found on the shores of the Elbe to a portrait of native film producer Nicholas Schieback. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to one of the four founders of the magazine, Urs Spindler.
We had the idea to make a magazine about Northern Europe for quite some time because we think that there's a lot of interesting things that binds this northern region together, like design, like music. I think Hamburg is kind of maybe the south pole of this northern region that then heads up to Scandinavia, to maybe also the UK. Well, this project actually failed. We made a dummy. It was called Norden, which is the German word for north. We didn't get enough funding to do it, but we had it in our back pockets when we started talking with the city of Hamburg about doing a new magazine. They liked the idea. They also liked the idea to try to bundle together a whole region and to try to, well, find topics that are not only typical for Hamburg, but maybe for a bit of a broader area. And then we just refocused and rebuilt the concept, and it became Gentle Rain.
Let's start with the cover. I mean, I have a copy in front of me, but can you describe to us the first cover and where did the idea came from?
So the first cover shows a person in a Godzilla costume and a young woman with a very typical Hamburg dress, a raincoat, a yellow raincoat. And there's a nice staircase, which is actually designed by the design office of Zaha Hadid. In the background, you see the tip of a building you will maybe come along a bit more often in the next few months or years. That is the new Elbphilharmonie of Hamburg. But you really see only the tip of it over the staircase. So that's the cover. And then there's, of course, a nice blue border and the logo of Gentle Rain.
But also moving on, I really like the topics. I mean, as I said, it's not an obvious guide for a city. I really like the interviews. For example, the interview with Evelyn Sibbett. She is, the owner of a pub called Sea Devil in Hamburg. That's such an interesting interview as well.
Yeah, I think everybody loves Evie. She's just a great character. And my colleague Malte used to live in a flat right next to the pub. So he knew her intimately, sort of. We went there a lot of times, and he got in the circle, so it was possible to make this interview with her. All in all, I think the topics are, well, there's of course a lot of Hamburg in the magazine, but there's also a lot of stuff in there that I think many people can relate to that live in bigger cities or, I'd say cities of millions, basically, because we try to search for topics that are relevant, not only for people who are here, but also for people who are maybe living in London or maybe living in some other city. I don't know if you, for example, read the piece about the Sternschanze, which is a place in very central in Hamburg that used to be a quite rough neighborhood and that now has become, rather posh, I'd say. It still has some spaces that are, have more of an alternative air. But all in all, it's a very good example for how cities transform these days and how people who live there take part in that, but also maybe opposed to it. And, I think that's something that maybe you can relate to when you look at Shoreditch, for example, in London or at similar areas. I think it's maybe relevant even for you as well.
You know what? I actually was quite relevant because I really like the nature as well. I believe you went on this hike as well in the district of Newark, which is quite a remote suburb of Hamburg, you know. Very beautiful pictures as well. That's a side of Hamburg as well that I didn't expect, to be honest.
Yeah, that's, I'd say, the piece that survived of the original idea to go far north. It's actually, it's really a part of Hamburg, but it's an enclave, basically, on the shore, and it's directly at the seaside, very beautiful. It's part of the World Heritage One Sea, and if you are in Hamburg, it's not so far. You can also go there by boat, but you can also just take a train to Cuxhaven and then go from there. It's very easy and it's very beautiful. So, yeah, of course, it's also a side of Hamburg we love to show.
And also, for those who are already thinking, when is the second issue coming out? How often do you want Gentle Rain on the newsstands? You know, I don't know, twice a month, or what's the frequency that you're thinking?
Well, if we had all the resources we wished for, we would maybe do it 4 times a year. Right now, we are planning on releasing the next issue in spring next year. So it would be 2 times a year. That's also something, of course, that you may feel in the magazine. Most of the stories are a little bit timeless. It doesn't really have much of a guidebook character, so it will not, I don't know, tell you about the next events in the next few weeks or something. It's more about getting a general feel for the city of Hamburg and for, what's around here. So, right now, 6 months for each issue, we will take a lot of time to make it as good as possible.
That was Urs Spindler, one of the founders of Gentle Rain, in conversation with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Jeremy Leslie still with me, primed for some delving. a few magazines before him. Jeremy, as always, where should we start?
Well, I've got two brand new magazines, and I have another one which I've already mentioned, but I'll come to that. Have a look at Racket magazine, which is an American magazine about tennis, as the name would suggest.
Now, I love, even from range, yeah. I love the cover of this.
Yes.
Paint a picture in words, Jeremy, for our listeners.
It's a classic piece of illustration. It's, I'm not sure it's a particular tennis player, but it's a beautiful kind of stylized tennis shot being played, a big forearm smash with the ball flying off the page. Lovely bit of typography for the title.
And it's got that kind of deco flourish. It looks a bit like one of those old tube posters imploring people to go and visit the Lawn Tennis Championship.
It's very deco and of that time. which is not to say that the magazine is retro in other respects. It uses these styles.
Deco with a contemporary flourish. I'm gonna throw that in there.
And twist.
Exactly. And so talk to us a little bit about the content.
It's so people often ask me, and I'm sure you know it comes up in conversations here on the stack. So where's there a gap in the market? Where can I launch a magazine? And there's quite a lot of sports magazines, a lot of football magazines, a lot of cycling magazines. But there's nothing about tennis. And when I heard about this a few months ago, I thought, yeah, that makes sense. That could be a great magazine. And on the evidence, the first issue, it promised, I think it is going to develop.
So is it, Jeremy? Is it a smash hit? See what I've done there? Pretty good.
I can't keep up. I think it probably is, or it certainly could be. I think, you know, there's so much kind of cultural history around tennis from the kind of sneakers side of things and the fashion side of things. And it has had, it's a sort of sport in this country. We only kind of pay attention during Wimbledon, I think, but it's going on all year. It's a big money sport and there's a lot of kind of history and culture and background to be given to it. And I think this magazine is going to manage to deliver that quite.
So having a quick flick through the pages, anything that sort of particularly anything sort of jumped out at you? There's some, I mean, as you can imagine, there's some, I can already see some beautiful photography.
There's a lot of historical photography.
Some lovely old archive stuff.
There's curiosities like the time Muhammad Ali played tennis. There's some great fashion from the 60s when people were kind of experimenting with, particularly with women's tennis gear. And there's a great series of sort of posters to do with bands. I mean, obviously it's about tennis, but it also spins off into things like, you know, tennis venues as locations for gigs and stuff like that. So there's a look
spins
at that.
Spins off? That's another tennis piece. It's pretty good. It's pretty good for a pun watch.
I think that might be cricket.
Is it? No, you can put backspin,
no,
topspin.
You can. No, true. You can do it. But it's a lovely, it's an elegant mix. You know, it uses the language of independent publishing. It's not a surprise in that sense, but it's I think got a good lot of content and stuff to delve into. I think it's going to be a very interesting magazine.
And it is interesting. It's funny that idea you had about little niches in the market, and sometimes people talk about, oh, you know, where's there a niche that we can fill? And sometimes I think maybe that's not the right approach for launching a magazine, because you need to have something where it's your passion and it's regardless
absolutely
to what the market says.
Yeah.
And yet in this case, you see this magazine, you think, oh, actually, that's really good. Why was that not there before?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I guess it can do both of those things.
But to be clear, I mean, the people behind this, they're tennis fanatics.
Nuts.
I mean that's where they come from. So they weren't looking for the niche. But a lot of people do have that approach, and I don't think that's the most
way to
healthy
go
way.
Excellent. Okay, well, that's an excellent start. Tell me the next magazine you've got there, Jeremy. There's another splash of summer colour on the front.
There is.
Does that inform us as to where we're headed?
In part, perhaps, in part. We're headed to Scotland, which might not immediately think of sun and brightness and stuff. But what's Vanguards is a magazine from a couple of students up in Scotland, a couple of design students. As such, it looks great and it feels great. The cover is, I think, Risograph printed, so it's got that vivid colour to it. What I love about this is that it avoids all the clichés of Scotland. You will not find pages of tartan and the kind of the expected here. They've gone for the craft angle in terms of the kind of the fantastic craftsmanship and the things that have been made locally. And it's a really nice sort of insight into a part of the Scottish life that perhaps people don't know about.
And it does seem there's a bit of an inexhaustible appetite wherever we go in the world for these titles that look at, you know, I want to try and stay clear of cliche, but, you know, artisanal making, provenance, craft, people kind of doing things properly by hand. And that seems to be a trend. I mean, it's something that we're very much kind of into. Mm-hmm. And this looks like the latest.
But I think it's a kind of, it's a sort of mutually reflective thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the one hand, making a magazine is largely a kind of, at this level, a sort of artisanal craftsman's kind of role. And I think it makes the subject and the form suit each other very well. Mm-hmm.
And do we know, you mentioned there's still students, is that right? Precocious talents.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
certainly ones to watch. And in terms of the way it looks, I mean, it's a smaller format, we should say, and it's got some of the kind of flourishes that people familiar with the kind of indie scene will be familiar with. But it looks like a nice blend. They've got some
I think it is. I mean, and the cover's very strong, And there are familiar kind of visual tropes inside, but I think again, much like Racket, as a launch issue, and particularly coming from two such relatively inexperienced well, such a relatively inexperienced team, I think it's a very strong start. So I'm interested to see what they do as
absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely, talents
forward.
To watch. We love this narrative on the stack of yes. great talents emerging, like beautiful flowers. Jeremy, where should we go now? Now, you did mention again earlier in the show.
Yes. So the team from Lady Beard are going to be speaking at ModMag, and they have just published their second issue, and I'm very excited about this. I think the first issue. Well, I should explain. Lady Beard, as the name suggests, it tries to break down the gender barriers between female and male and just come at things from a particularly feminist point of view, but trying to have a very particular point of view that's open for both men and women to enjoy and look and deal with. And obviously doing sex with the first issue is a very challenging one. They did it very, very well, but then in a sense, there was some sort of... certainly in the review we ran on Mag Culture, it was kind of, well, they've come in with a bang. How can they follow up with that? And I think when I heard they were doing Mind, I mean, the sex issue was hugely visual and very challenging and provocative in that sense. And I wondered whether they'd managed to match that with Mind. Mm. And I'm pleased to say they absolutely have. It's a really exciting issue. From the cover on, it has the same strength of illustration and photography and created kind of content to do with photo stories, etc. Mm. But also really sound written content. It has taken almost a year to produce the second issue, so they put a lot
great,
into it.
Exactly, but great things take time. And I think it's interesting, we were just reflecting on the fact that you've got early, you know, new magazines from maybe younger teens or a little more inexperienced, and it's exciting to think where they might go. And that's the great challenge, especially if you've done well with issue one.
Yeah.
Can you live up to it? And maybe that's the way. Take a bit of time, and it means you can get things right. And in terms of the editorial approach, it's nice to see themes or an approach that you can identify as running through, even if it's a year apart and the subject matter can be quite different.
Yes, absolutely. And it's the kind of scope and the time they put into making it means that it's so broad. I mean, it's a proper read. It's a really strong content, beautifully produced. I'm a real fan of the design of it. I think it's really strong in its presentation. It has a really clear identity, but it doesn't overwhelm the imagery.
It's very clean, isn't it?
Yeah. But you kind of fall into cliches of clean and minimal, but it's more than that. It's a very subtle design that allows some great photography and illustration and structural devices to shine through. There's a beauty. I mean, the cover and the opening illustrations are by Rose Pilkington, and they run through all the different sections and really bring it to life and sort of give a kind of almost a scientific feel to the idea of Mind. But then within that, there's all sorts of, you know, there's pieces about mental states. There's a great opening set of stories about just from individuals who at some point have had some sort of breakdown, whether serious or minor, but just presented without comment, but just people's personal first person stories.
Very moving stuff. Well, great. What an excellent selection, Jeremy. Thank you. Thanks as always for sharing your insights. Most of those magazines, you should be able to get hold of them here and there. You can find more at Mag Culture, and that's where you need to go to find out more about the big event next month.
Absolutely.
We might speak to you again before then. Who knows?
I hope so.
Let's hope.
And of course, you can buy them at the Mag Culture shop.
There you go, you see. It's your one-stop shop. Jeremy Leslie, great to see you. Thanks for being with us as always.
Welcome. Thank you.
And finally, today, the Brooklyn Book Festival gets underway this weekend. It's New York City's largest free literary event, attracting an international selection of guests. Joyce Carol Oates, Margaret Atwood and A.O. Scott are just some of the writers in attendance this year. Festival founder Johnny Temple spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco from our New York bureau.
For a lot of people living in Brooklyn in the very early 21st century, it seemed obvious that we needed a very big book festival. And around the same time that we started, New York City's biggest book festival at that time was called New York is Book Country. And that festival just stopped going. I don't know what happened, but they stopped, which created an opening. Ironically, we had already been planning our festival, but they stopped right as we were debuting ours. So we quickly became New York City's biggest book festival. The festival is set in Brooklyn, but it's an international book festival. And the borough of Brooklyn has an incredible literary legacy, which dates back at least as far as the middle of the 19th century, when Walt Whitman was the editor of the Brooklyn Daily Eagle, and then continues from there up until in the 1930s, Richard Wright wrote some of Native Son in Brooklyn, which became the first best-selling book ever by an African-American author. And then these days, you know, Brooklyn is the home of authors such as Colson Whitehead, Jonathan Safran Foer, Nelson George, Jhumpa Lahiri, Jennifer Egan, and on and on and on. I think there's more writers, published writers per capita in Brooklyn than perhaps any other place. So it's a great fit, and the festival has really catalyzed Brooklyn becoming the center of New York publishing rather than across the river in Manhattan.
Junior, I just want to know a bit more about the structure of the festival. I believe, you know, Sunday the 18th is the big day, but, you know, the week before, there's also lots of events happening in Brooklyn as well, right?
That's right. Starting this past Monday, we started having bookend events, which are events across all five boroughs of New York City, not just Brooklyn, but all around the city, featuring authors in various types of programming, whether it's musical performances or readings, panel discussions, et cetera, et cetera. So every night there are many events around the city, starting on Monday all the way up through Sunday. So there's probably around 50 bookend events leading up to Saturday the 17th is our dedicated Children's Day, which is a outdoor public event with indoor and outdoor stages. And then the next day, Sunday the 18th, is the big day of the festival, which will include about 15 different stages, about 300 authors appearing in programs on those 15 different stages, and about maybe 200 exhibitors, book publishers, literacy organizations, literary journals, and other organizations and companies connected to literature, handing out information, selling books, etc. It's a huge outdoor marketplace, and definitely a can't-miss event for someone who loves books and is in New York City at that time.
And Johnny, for this year's festival, how would you say are kind of, you know, the main themes, or also a special author that's coming perhaps for the first time?
One author that I'm excited about that we've never had before is a horror writer named Peter Straub, who is going to be appearing on a program with Joyce Carol Oates and Marjorie Liu. And we've never had a horror writer of that stature at the festival. So I wouldn't necessarily say that event is the center of the event, but it is one that stands out to me as being unique to this year. We have Salman Rushdie appearing on two different programs. We've got the phenomenal British author Jeff Dyer coming in. And he's always a blast to have. So there is not an overarching theme, but in the 300 authors we're featuring, there's also dozens of authors who have never appeared on our stages before.
Well, that sounds very good to me, Johnny. Thank you so much for being on the show, and I wish I was there in Brooklyn this week.
Thank you for having us, and if you would like more information, brooklynbookfestival.org is our website.
Johnny Temple, founder of the Brooklyn Book Festival, which kicks off from 10 a.m. this Sunday, in conversation there with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. That's all we have time for on this week's show. What a jam-packed effort it was. Thanks to our producers, Ben Rylan and Fernando, and of course, as always, to our editor, Claire Urban. Drop us a note at info@monocle.com, and don't forget to tune in at the very same time next Saturday. You can catch up, if you're missing us before then, at monocle.com or via iTunes. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you for tuning in.